This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Man kann sein Glück aussehen, es hegen und pflegen, langsam wachsen sehen, darauf warten.
Oder man reißt es einfach auf.
Die Lose zum Aufreißen von Lotto Bayern. Das Bayernlos, das Bayernglück, das Extragehalt oder das Megagehalt. Reiß dein Glück auf. Nur in deiner Lottoannahmestelle. Lotto Bayern. Nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Infos unter bjoerg.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. This series, we're on the trail of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel round the world, from the UK to the US and Australia and back through time to meet women who didn't play by the rules. And what might their crimes and the times they live in teach us about women's lives today? Let me take you to Australia to introduce you to Tilly Devine, gangland queen of 1920s Sydney. Draped in furs and dripping with jewels, she's the madam of one of the most lucrative brothel networks the city's ever seen.
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
She is a prostitute of the worst type, and an associate of prostitutes, vagrants, and criminals.
I have more diamonds than the Queen of England.
She was more than a handful, even for my male colleagues. She was frightened of nobody.
Tilly Devine, top gangster, has strikingly blonde hair fixed into fashionable curls. And don't be deceived by her pretty face. She's the first to get stuck into a brawl, and she's no stranger to the inside of a prison cell. There's going to be illicit liquor, all-night parties, and dangerous brawls. We're in East Sydney, Darlinghurst, Woolloomooloo, and King's Cross. In the 1920s and 30s, these streets are known as the most perilous in Australia. Tilly Devine is a woman on the make. She excels at making money from crime. We'll find out what brings her from South London to Sydney and how in just a decade she becomes queen of the underworld. But will she survive a game of cat and mouse with the police and a bitter feud with her nemesis, fellow gangland queen, Kate Lee? Well, I am delighted to be joined by historian and author Professor Lee Straw from the University of Notre Dame in Fremantle, Australia. What she doesn't know about Tilly Devine isn't worth knowing. She has written multiple books about Sydney's criminal underworld, and we're honoured to have you with us, Lee. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Now, can I ask you, Tilly had a Cockney accent. Where does her life begin?
Well, her life begins in Camberwell. She's regarded as a Camberwell lass when she makes it over to Australia. And I mean, you know, that Cockney accent, that stands right out when she gets to Sydney. So she starts her life in Camberwell. It's a life that takes her onto the street and a very different life than I think she may or her family might have imagined.
What did her parents do?
You've got this kind of background of, you know, sort of working class folk, but at the same time, Tilly has these, we kind of hint at she has these aspirations from an early age that she's kind of taken in with some of the highlights of the other side of town. So she, in her teenage years, is looking to make something of herself.
And how does she go about doing that?
Well, she starts working on the streets and she is referred as prostitute at the time. We would talk more these days about sex workers. So she's working on the streets. She's a teenager. And, you know, that for the historian looking at those circumstances is in some respects a little bit problematic as a teenager working that, you know, that kind of hard life.
Gosh. What kind of a person was she physically and in her character?
She was very strikingly pretty in her younger years. And, you know, as a woman, I kind of, that point of pointing out she's pretty, there's already the feminist in me that's going, ugh. But that mattered, you know, in terms of the work that she was doing. And it really did matter in terms of her appearance. She was blonde, blue-eyed. She was quite slight of figure and quite a standout when she could dress herself up and working on the streets.
It's while she's working the streets of London that she meets and marries Jim Devine, a roguish Australian serviceman. At the end of the First World War, he returns to Australia and Tilly follows after him. Lee, do we know anything about her voyage out?
So I've got here for you, Lucy, this is actually the inward passenger list for one of the ships that was coming over bringing some of these war brides. This is actually from the New South Wales State Archives collection. And I'm excited about this because this is the kind of material that archivists find and they really, you know, engage so well with the historical profession and giving us some information that we've got wrong before. We had Tilly Devine on the wrong ship. She's here on the Matatua, February of 1920.
That is exciting. And here we've got the names of the passengers. And under the females, we have got Mrs. Devine. So, a young and a not-so-innocent Tilly arrives at Circular Quay, which is beside the Sydney Harbour Bridge. She's greeted by her husband, Jim, and all that 1920s Sydney has to offer. It's the time at the Charleston. All-night parties, and a generation doing their best to forget the horrors of war. The Devines head for East Sydney, that's the red light district. Tilly and Jim feel right at home on these hectic, bustling streets. Tilly gets straight back to work in the business that she knows so well, with Jim acting as her pimp. Author Larry Reiter has explored Sydney's criminal history in the 20s in his book Underbelly Razor. Lee, you also know this area of Sydney very well. Can you paint a picture for us of what it was like in the 20s?
Yeah, look, I had the wonderful experience of living around Darlinghurst and King's Cross and Surrey Hills a number of years ago. And you actually didn't have to stretch the imagination to really think of what it had actually looked like in the early 20th century. What you were finding is a very impoverished area. There's a sense, real sense of community. And I think for someone like Tilly, she would have found a bit of resonance there because it's not a huge stretch to go from London, from Camberwell, to really understand that, to then go to this part of Sydney.
Sounds like things are going quite well for Tilly, doesn't it? But that's about to change. Unfortunately for her, New South Wales has recently set up its first women's police force, specifically to target female criminals and to support female victims of crime. Lillian Armfield, one of the very first recruits, is a highly moral person and very resilient too. She's well aware of what she's letting herself in for in her new profession.
I'm expecting plenty of trouble. For women are found difficult to handle by their own sex and will probably be more likely to resent interference from me than from a policeman.
The papers are suitably impressed by Lillian.
She has a smile that will surely help her to win her way into the hearts of the women with whom she will have to deal.
Well, I'm not sure if Lillian Armfield is going to win Tilly's heart. Now, joining me to discuss life as a female police officer is Christine Nixon, the first female chief commissioner in an Australian state police force and author of Fair Cop, a book about her life with the police. Hello, Christine. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. Lovely to join you.
Now, Christine, Lillian was one of the first female police officers in New South Wales. You also joined the police as a young woman and went on to become very senior indeed. What's it like being a woman in this male-dominated profession?
Well, I can certainly relate to Lillian. As she joined in 1915, I joined in 1972, and the number of women police hadn't changed. So we both really faced organisations with significant numbers of men and very small numbers of women. In fact, Lillian, of course, there was only two women. And by the time I got there, 130.
Are you saying that there was the same proportion of men to women in 1915 yeah. and in the 1970s? That's amazing.
I am. It took until probably the 80s until things started to change. But certainly, I think that Lillian, she would have done a fine job, gone on with, well, with most of the blokes. She just did her job. And I think my own experience is pretty much like that. When you're one of a very small number, you really do just have to get on, do your job better than the blokes do. And then they generally accept you. But I have to say, being in charge, of course, is pretty helpful as well.
I love that, as you were later on. Brilliant, brilliant. Mm-hmm. Now, let's go on with the story. Lillian joins the police force at a really good time, actually, because there are dramatic changes afoot in the criminal world in Sydney. By 1925, the city becomes known for its organised crime.
Abnormal post-war lawlessness has grown appallingly. Armed hold-ups, bank robberies, murders and monstrous sex crimes revealing a depth of fiendishness almost unbelievable are weekly happenings.
One particular criminal entrepreneur is rising to the top. And guess who this lady might be? Yes, it's Tilly Devine. At the same time, though, innovations in policing are giving these organised crime gangs a run for their money. In Australia, the mugshot is becoming a revolutionary new method of tracing and capturing criminals. Photos of the most notorious crooks are taken and memorised. The Rogues Gallery becomes the Sydney Police Force's new Bible. Lillian has the task of learning to recognise the faces of the female offenders and to investigate Sydney's prostitution industry. She goes undercover to track Tilly down. Now back to you, Christine. It would have put Lillian in danger, wouldn't it? To what extent does that sort of thing go on in your experience today, and how dangerous is it?
Certainly for her, it would have been incredibly dangerous. As a youngster, I was young and blonde, and sometimes they'd put me out to work undercover as well. But in those days, there weren't a lot of protections.
Could you tell me a bit about what a sort of undercover situation might have been for you?
I've pretended to be an airline hostess. I've pretended to be a bikie's girlfriend, which was interesting. One of the other ones I did was they were looking for a particular rapist, and they set me up in a fairly remote location and hoped that he might come and try and grab me.
Oh, Christine.
Yes, it was. I wasn't so sure about this idea. He did, in fact, come along. And I think he maybe decided he didn't quite like the look of me and kept walking, but it was sufficient. He met the mugshot that we had, and he was arrested by my colleagues. But you can find yourself in difficult places sometimes.
My goodness, you were the bait for a rapist.
Yes.
And they didn't get him.
I was the bait.
Oh, yep, my goodness.
That's part of the job.
Now, listen to this. Once Tilly Devine's face had been memorised by Lillian and her fellow officers, she gets arrested. And again and again. Between 1921 and 1925, Tilly Devine is arrested 79 times. Now, the Police and Justice Museum in Sydney has the original records of all of Tilly's offences, and we met lead archivist Colleen Milicevic to find out more about Tilly's rap sheet.
We're here in the police court on Phillip Street in Sydney. It's right down near Circular Quay on the harbour. It was a very busy courtroom. It's a court of petty sessions, which was the lowest level of court in New South Wales. There's a wooden bench inside a metal cage, and the cage was designed to keep the prisoner from escaping during the matter or from indeed attacking anyone in the courtroom. Now, keeping in mind that she'd only been in the country for 5 years, and I'm holding a list in front of me, which is literally as long as your arm. And this report lists all of the offences that Tilly had been charged with up until May 1925. It's fascinating how close together these offences are. When you look at this list, it's unbelievable. There's only really a couple of weeks in between some of these appearances in court. There's indecent language, there's assault, riotous behaviour, she's been charged with being drunk, assaulting a constable, stealing, being a common prostitute, and the most recent one was contempt of court. I don't know that anyone else would have spent so much time in the courtroom as Tilly Devine.
And we have mugshots of Tilly from this time. The first photographs of her on record, actually, and perhaps the ones that Lillian used to commit her face to memory. Here's Tilly having just been sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Look, in this photo too, Tilly has quite a sad face, and that's because she's just been sentenced to 2 years in jail. So, you know, she's not a happy lassie at this moment. The finishing touch to this outfit is a pair of what appear to be black velvet high heels. And this shoe is significant because just a few weeks before this photo was taken, she was accused of flinging her shoe at a police constable in the police station dock, and she donged him right on the nose and caused his nose to bleed. So not only did she like to wear the latest fashion, she also liked to wield the latest fashion as a weapon when the opportunity arose.
Tilly's conviction in 1925 to 2 years behind bars gives her ample time to plan for her future. Will she reform and put crime behind her, perhaps? Not a chance. But there is one thing she's sure of by the time she leaves prison. Her days as a sex worker are over. There's no way she's going back to frontline work on the streets. She starts to form a new plan which exploits a loophole in the law. It might be illegal for a male pimp to profit from the earnings of sex workers, but it's not illegal for a female pimp to do so. Tilly buys a property at 191 Palmer Street to set up her first brothel. And soon she adds many other properties to her portfolio. She's on her way to running the most extensive string of bordellos that Sydney's ever seen. Let's go back to historian Lee Straw. Lee, author Larry Reiter calls Tilly a benevolent despot. What do you think her brothels were like?
That's one of the fascinating things, isn't it? Using your historical imagination to really bring it to life through what we know. The brothels were actually quite well known for the interior decor. Tilly was very interested in making sure that the interior of the brothels looked really good because she's a businesswoman. She wants the customers to come in and feel like this is a pretty good establishment. I feel somewhat safe here and it looks nice. There would be music. Her workers would be sat about so that the customers coming in could make choices in terms of, of her workers. But you would also have the work that she was doing in the brothels, along with also the sideline other criminal activity that's going on as well, the kind of the silent stuff going on in the back rooms and so on.
And what sort of reaction did Tilly have to the police officer, Lillian Armfield? At this point, the police have Tilly in her sights, don't they? But they haven't yet quite realised what she's capable of.
Oh, Tilly had the most outlandish, terrible reactions to a lot of people, I think. But when it came to Lillian Armfield and then later on other women who were working as a part of the women's police, she was not very quiet about how much she hated them. She didn't like that these were women who were getting the one up on her. So there's stories that have been handed down, and the locals used to talk about it a fair bit as well, that Tilly would walk behind Lillian Armfield or other members of the women's police and she would be hissing at them from behind and saying, I hate you. And so this animosity was really there, it's palpable in terms of being out in public and following these women around.
By the late 1920s, she's running 18 thriving brothels. Her wealth's becoming almost legendary. Her money and her power redefining what it means to be a woman in a man's world. But at the same time, another woman is also rising to become a powerful gangland boss. Kate Lee is building her empire from illicit liquor, cocaine, and stolen goods. Kate really hates Tilly, and the feeling's mutual. There's only room for one Queen of Vice in Sydney. Things are about to turn nasty. Lee, you've written a whole book about Kate Lee, the worst woman in Sydney, you call her. Who was she, and why did she and Tilly hate each other so much?
Kate, for starters, would hate the title of that, the worst woman in Sydney. And it was one of the male detectives had called her this and she had said, I'm not the worst woman in Sydney. That's Tilly Devine. what we have, it's brilliant. What we have with these two women is a fascinating study into powerful women who are running the organised crime scene in East Sydney in the 20s and the 30s.
Is it fair to say that there's also something in common between the two women, which is that they've both spotted and exploited a weakness in the law, which is that men are banned from profiting from brothels or selling alcohol out of hours, but nobody had bothered to ban women from doing the same things.
Absolutely. That's the interesting thing, is that they are two intelligent women who see that there is here a loophole, that the police, their attention is very much on the business of men. What are men doing? How are they controlling brothels? And there's two really interesting things about both Kate and Tilly in this situation. One is that they have men who work for them who are willing to take the fall. So if the police do raids, they will say, it's our stuff, right? That's smart. That's how organised crime operates. And the other part of that really interesting story with the two of them is that they also recognised that the detectives were not yet onto the fact that, lo and behold, two women could be running organised crime in East Sydney at the time.
I love it. Hiding in plain sight. Christine, as a former police chief commissioner, do you have anything to add here? How did these two women, Kate and Tilly, get away with it?
I think they certainly were getting away with it. And probably that was really about the times that they're in. But of course, you also had senior police, politicians, prominent people in the communities who were also involved in the use of prostitution. I mean, all of that was supported, particularly, I think, within policing and politics more than anything else. I certainly kind of in a bit more modern time, New South Wales had this title called the Barbecue Set, which was, again, a group of corrupt police officers.
No.
I think the other thing, just listening to the story as well, is the idea that how could women possibly behave like this? You know, how could they be the ones that were smart enough to make money out of it? And I guess the two women sort of exploited that opportunity as well.
The rivalry between Tilly and Kate soon becomes vicious. There simply isn't room for two women at the top. But it's a change in the law that makes the fight turn really nasty. In 1927, the Pistol Licensing Act makes it a prisonable offence to hold an unlicensed firearm. So, Tilly and Kate's henchmen swap their guns for razors. The razor's a weapon that can inflict a horrific wound, disfiguring a person for life. And so ubiquitous do these razors become that Darlinghurst is renamed as Razorhurst. The newspapers get themselves into a razor-related frenzy.
The harvest of hackings and slicings and stabbings is being garnered in all parts of the metropolis.
This is the hour of the glistening blade and crimes of violence.
The razor is more effective than the revolver as a cash extractor. The sheen of its bright blade, close to his cheek, puts deadly fear into the heart of the victim.
And it's not just the henchmen who are using the razors. Tilly carried one of these close contact weapons herself. Here's lead archivist Colleen Milicevic at the Police and Justice Museum in Sydney.
Tilly herself was known to use a razor. She was arrested for malicious wounding, where she attacked a man by the name of Sidney Cork in a hairdresser's in Surry Hills, and she walked right up to him, pulled the razor out, and slashed him. And the injury to Sidney Cork was quite terrible. The hairdresser said that the blood from the injury splattered all over him, and it was also described as being 4 feet up the wall of the hairdressing salon. So she really did do some damage with this very small but very dangerous weapon.
Gosh, Tilly really is ruthless. The feud between the two gangland bosses reaches a crescendo on the 8th of August 1929 in the Kellett Street Brawl. Will the title of Queen of the Underworld finally be decided? The rival gangs exchange jibes and threats, and before long, they're throwing bottles and stones at each other. Then they fight with their fists, with knives and with guns. It is a brutal fight, but there's no clear winner. The police arrive to find four men and one woman violently injured, but not one of them will speak to the detectives, and the rest of the gangsters flee off into the night. Let's go back to former police officer Christine Nixon. Does this sound familiar to you, gang on gang violence?
Oh, as you were just speaking about it, it's very familiar. Both the kind of confrontation that they obviously had, that still happens. And then the next piece is when the police turn up and there are injured people. None of them want to tell you what happened. And that happens today.
Now, back in the 1920s, it is just not clear who's on top, Tilly or Kate. But the citizens of Sydney are sick of the violence. And the police are closing in. Officer Lillian Armfield is pictured in a newspaper called The Truth in her cloche hat and her string of pearls. She's heralded by the papers as the person with the skills and the determination needed to bring these incorrigible criminals into line. Here's the twist the crime bosses didn't see coming. It is, in fact, Lillian and the police who are going to win over the Queen's advice. That's because new legislation is introduced. It's called the New South Wales Vagrancy Amendment Act of 1929 that has in it something called the Consorting Clause. And this means that known criminals seen together, just seen together, can get arrested. And it's under this law that Tilly gets caught in 1930. And after 10 years, this is the chance the authorities have to get rid of her for good. Now, Tilly, who's always very canny, she strikes a deal. She promises the judge that if he doesn't convict her, she'll go home to England. Shortly after this, she's seen on the decks of the luxury liner, the Otranto. She's wearing a pretty blue coat, a red beret, she has diamonds on her fingers, and as the ship sets sail, her parting words to Australia ring out.
There are lots in Sydney who will miss me, even the police, as I hope never to come back.
Huh. But is that really the last of Tilly Devine? I'm joined by historian Lee Straw. Lee, what happens next?
Tilly loved the attention. She loved to set up this scenario of, you know, I'm not coming back. I'm, you know, going off to England. Everyone's going to be happy to see the back of me. But the reality is that she did come back. That's the businesswoman side of Tilly as well, that she didn't want to stay too long away from actually controlling those businesses because, you know, if she stepped out of it too long, somebody would step into those shoes.
And what finally spells Tilly's demise as a queen of crime?
As is the case of very well-known organised crime figures around the world and continues through into our contemporary times, that's actually a big tax issue that brings down Tilly Devine. So the tax department's been looking, I know, and it's, you sort of think of it now and think, oh my goodness, really? So Tilly loses a lot of her wealth. Ultimately, it's the tax man that comes to bring down Tilly Devine.
Lee, you've spent a lot of your life sort of living with Tilly Devine, haven't you? What's your final conclusion? Is she bold, brazen, but ultimately bad?
There's a pause there in how I'm responding because, you know, the interesting thing is that you can have your interpretation of Tilly. She was very intelligent. She was ahead of her time in terms of being able to be that business person, that entrepreneur. And I find that really fascinating. I find the violent side to her life, I find that quite jarring.
Let's come back to you, Christine. What are your final thoughts on Tilly Devine?
Well, you'd have to have some respect for her on the basis of how powerful she was, but she was also incredibly violent and sponsored a huge amount of violence and harm. So I guess, in some ways, Lillian's a bit familiar to me, that no matter what happens, in the end, the police win. And that's what happened with Lillian. And I think that's what we try for as well.
Oh, I just love that female comradeship across a whole century between the two of you. It's nice, isn't it?
It is.
Fabulous. Tilly Devine arrives in Sydney with nothing more than the gritty determination to make it in a man's world. In Australia, her star shines brightly. She amasses a fortune that remains the stuff of folk legend. But what goes up must come down. And the money made from crime can be slippery. Tilly's blinded by feuding with her nemesis and brings about her own undoing. She flew too close to the sun. And perhaps her story offers a warning, not to let ambition cloud your judgment. A huge thank you to our historian, Lee Straw, and our guest detective, the former Chief Commissioner of Victoria Police, Christine Nixon. Next time, we're off to North Wales to meet an Edwardian fake heiress with a taste for the high life. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Emily Hughes, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Jonathan Keeble, and Guy Dowsainter. The historical consultant is Rosalind Crone. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. And the commissioning editor is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.
It's Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, Central Intelligence. From BBC Radio 4, about the birth of the CIA. Secrets, lies, covert operations. The inside story from a real-life agency legend. Starring Ed Harris, Johnny Flynn, and me, Kim Cattrall. To hear Central Intelligence and many other great drama podcasts, search for Limelight on BBC Sounds.